Disclaimer: the views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show! I'm Zach Birchie. Joining me, let me start that over again. Hey, everybody! I'm Zach Birchie. Welcome to Ancast. We got a little first segment up here. Justin's here.
Hey, how is everybody? Jesus, I'm a mess today.
It's okay. Justin's here. How's it going, man?
Pretty good. How are you?
I've been better, but things are getting better, so I think I'm okay.
Good.
We're going to take some Twitter questions up here up top, but, have you been watching anything lately? It's been a little while since we've just sort of, you know, talked about that.
Yeah, no, I actually, haven't been watching Jack because I just came off of this really, really, really heavy work month and I'm just kind of decompressing at this point.
Oh, yeah, well, that happens.
Plus it's Oscar season, so I have my hands full catching up with actual movies.
Yeah, there's a lot to see, right now and more in the coming, next couple of months. The only thing I watched was, I checked out the Funimation Helsing release, which is really nice. I don't see how they could have possibly done a better job. It's really loaded up with extras. The OVAs themselves look great. It's episodes that have been released before, so there's no new dub material on here, but, it's good to see that they got the dub cast back together for that one. My love affair with that show is over, but, especially ever since the manga ended, but, It's a quality release. Like, if you're a fan, that's the thing to have. And, you know, just in time for Halloween and all that. So.
Right. I have a big Right Stuff order on the way, but it hasn't gotten here yet. They were having a Section 23 sale.
Mm-hmm.
So that new Grave of the Fireflies Blu-ray is a must-have, obviously.
Right.
And then I completely forgot that they released Detroit Metal City.
Oh, yeah. They did.
It's sub only, which I'm surprised. I keep thinking that would have more mainstream appeal, but I guess all those rape jokes would be really, really hard to dub without being terrible.
Yeah. Well, they're not really... I mean,
they're not actual rape jokes, yeah. But it's still characters screaming rape gleefully.
Right.
So, yeah, that would make for kind of awkward dubbing. And let's face it, that dub crew is not known for its subtlety.
Well, given the way the internet reacts to things like that now, like, God, I just wouldn't even want to step in that minefield. Like,
yeah.
Most people who see Detroit Metal City, like, seem to get it, and they don't seem offended by it, but put that out dubbed, it'll get a little bit more mainstream attention, and then suddenly Tumblr explodes. And then we hear about nothing but that for, like, a month.
Yeah, probably for the best. They didn't dub that.
Yeah.
So I have that on order, and I just put in my big expensive order with Yes Asia for the Only Yesterday Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah. How much did you end up paying for that?
80-something.
Yeah.
Worth every penny, but my God, Japanese Blu-rays just... You can't buy one without feeling a little violated.
Oh, yeah, totally. They're crazy. That has English subs on it, right?
Yes, thank God. And those Blu-rays are really loaded up. They have the whole storyboard. They have, I think they have the Japanese script. Not that that really helps me that much.
Right.
But, English subs. So I feel good about buying it. And, you know, I'm quite sure this will not get a reasonably priced American version in the near future, so this won't be like when I bought all the Region 2s of, like, Porco Rosso and Kiki, only to shoot myself 3 months later.
Only Yesterday, yeah, I could see that. I could see that not coming out over here. I just assume Totoro will be out at some point, so I'm not gonna...
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Probably the next wave.
Yeah. I wouldn't doubt it. That's generally how it goes. They wait about a year, and then we get them here in the States.
Right.
At least that seems to be the release schedule pattern. I don't know.
I don't think there is a pattern. Disney seems to be kind of not sure what they want to do with Ghibli at this point.
Yeah. Well, no, they want to make a big... they put effort into the Arrietty release. And frankly, like, the home video release was nicely promoted, too. Like, there were lots of TV ads and It had prominent display in every store I saw it in, and I feel like they did put effort into that.
That's true. I don't know what to make of what on Poppy Hill? Something on Poppy
From
Hill?
From Up on Poppy Hill.
From Up on Poppy Hill, thank you. Because that went right to G-Kids, but that's also because, A, it's Gorō Miyazaki, so it's probably not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I've been hearing, it's okay at best.
Yeah, that's we have a review on the site. It got kind of like a B.
I believe says it's okay at best.
Yeah, basically. The story that I would believe that's not coming, that wouldn't come out from Disney for the same reason Only Yesterday wouldn't, is that
it's very Japanese.
It's super Japanese. They tend to stick to the more global audience friendly Ghibli titles.
Right.
For their official releases. I wasn't surprised at all to see that go. I'm surprised Earthsea didn't wind up going to some secondhand distributor.
Well, they didn't bother with a theatrical on that.
No, well, I mean festival screenings and stuff, but yeah, no actual no like 800 screen theatrical release like they did for Arrietty.
Right.
Yeah.
And thank God for that, because that would have just gotten savaged by the press.
It did anyway. The movie's terrible. Well,
you can only be an apologist for to such an extent just because it's from Japan. Then we're just like, well, yeah.
Well,
yes, it is terrible.
Well, people are apologists for Miyazaki at this point.
Not Gorō.
Well, not Gorō, but people do not seem to be willing to recognize the flaws in his most recent films. I feel like we're some of the only people that are like, yeah, he's slipping. But everybody else is still dutifully genuflecting in front of the man. I don't know.
It's amazing how many people, even critics, fall into this trap where they're judging someone's entire body of work when a new film comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not fair. Like, we just saw that happen with P.T. Anderson in The Master.
Yeah, that was a disappointing movie. I liked it, but it was basically bravado performances propping up not much of a story. And the conclusion felt like, okay, that's it. All right.
Yeah, that movie didn't really have a good reason to exist, although the performances were really good. I would have enjoyed it a lot more had I not desperately needed to pee for the last half of the movie. And that movie went on for like 3 hours.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I didn't have that experience, but I was lukewarm on it. But I, you know, There Will Be Blood is probably my all-time favorite movie, or number two or something like that.
It's hard to imagine him getting better than that, mind you.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, people peak and they ebb and flow. I mean, you know, one of my other favorite directors, Wes Anderson, has an ebb and flow right now. He's riding a high streak. But, you know, P.T. Anderson is at the beginning of his career. We're going to be seeing movies from him for decades. So, you know, he turned out one that wasn't fantastic. It was okay. But, yeah, the critics just, you know, 98% on Rotten Tomatoes or whatever. And it's like, no. It's okay.
That's a 65 at best.
Yeah, totally. I can see some Oscar nods coming for the performances, but I don't think anything else.
They say a director has, and any given director has 10 years of relevance, so.
I wonder if that bears out.
That's, some famous director said that. I think it was Fellini, but I might be wrong.
I don't know. Like, when you get into legendary directors, you know, Scorsese has had periods where he was irrelevant, and now he's relevant.
Right.
I would say you could probably say the same thing for Steven Spielberg, like, in the 90s, maybe.
Lincoln does not appear relevant.
Lincoln. Man. I'm going to see that. I think
really?
I'm going to see it. but it really does feel like a satire of a movie that gets made to win Oscars.
It looks like, I don't know. I am allergic to dramatic speeches that are clearly made to be delivered with a soft symphony behind it. Like, you know what other Spielberg movie was like? That was Amistad. And man, did that suck.
Yeah, Amistad was not. I mean, did you see War Horse?
Why would I see War Horse?
It was nominated for Best Picture.
There's an arbiter of quality.
I use that as a measuring stick. I'll see everything nominated for Best Picture. That movie was pure treacle, and I feel like Lincoln has definitely the capacity to be pure treacle, but we'll see. I don't know.
It also, like, anytime you're getting into dramatizations of obviously good points in American history.
Yeah.
And you attack it with too much bravado, it's just a recipe for just cringe-inducing jingoism, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's totally true. And I would like to see a... I don't know. I haven't seen the film yet. Maybe it does cover some of this ground. But I would like to see a biopic that does not flinch at actual history. Something that gives us the man, warts and all, so to speak, and not just this sort of patriotic cartoon.
That's the Abraham Lincoln equivalent of Downfall?
Sure. Not that there's that, but I look at the trailers for this and I go, oh, like, I'm sure there are things about this person and this time in history that were super unpleasant. We're not going to get any of that. I'm sure.
No, this is a very high budget film to play at the Lincoln Memorial Diorama.
Yeah, totally. I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to see it, mostly for Daniel Day-Lewis. But yeah, no, it looks like just pure awards bait. Historical cartoon kind of a thing. But we'll find out. I don't know.
Yeah. Looking forward to Cloud Atlas, though.
Yeah, yeah. I meant to see that today, but I had too much work to do. I'll see it over the weekend.
That's right. That opened today.
Yeah, opened up today. There's a few things out in the next couple of weeks that I'm interested in seeing. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to Cloud Atlas. I withhold all judgment on the race-bending stuff until I actually see it. In my mind, given the premise, all the complaining about that seems to be overblown, and no one who has seen the film seems to think that it's a big deal. That seems to be generally how that's going. And whenever that happens, whenever it's like there's a trailer and there's one element in it that a particularly vocal group finds really offensive, I prefer that they wait and see the finished product. You can't really judge art based on just one little, like, one screenshot or something.
Well, the last time that happened was The Last Airbender, and that was the least offensive thing about that
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, that movie had a lot of other problems. I'm open to the fact that they totally fucked it up, and it's really crappy and offensive, but something tells me it's not. At least everybody...
Well, no one who has seen it has said that.
Yeah, that's totally true. Anyway, we'll see it this weekend. We'll talk about it next week on the show.
Right.
So it seems like there's a lot to chew on there.
Yeah, I'm also, actually on Monday, I'm going to see there's the LA premiere and fundraiser for that documentary, Burn.
Haven't heard of it.
It follows a year with a team of Detroit firefighters.
Mm-hmm.
They actually had a Kickstarter that I kicked in for. And it's as someone who grew up in Detroit and remembers every Halloween morning waking up to helicopter shots of the city on fire. I've always been curious about, you know, what it's like to be someone who's on the ground trying to save a city that no one wants.
Right. Wow.
And like they were on the ground with these guys, and this one firefighting squadron was literally contending with 30 cases of arson a night in some cases.
Holy shit.
Yeah, like that city. I would think people who aren't familiar with Detroit realize the extent of how fucked up that city is.
I'm surprised there aren't more documentaries about that. You would think there would be a just pile up of documentary filmmakers in Detroit, wringing the emotion out of that situation.
Well, that's the thing. It's almost impossible. No one cares. Like, nobody cares. Like, these guys, and apparently they did have a grant from PBS going into it, but everyone, even PBS, is like, I'm not sure there's enough story here, and even now they can't get funding for distro.
Wow.
So, like, that's why this is a fundraiser, because they're trying to get it, but, like, this apparently is a great doc. It won an audience award at Tribeca.
Mm-hmm.
I've offered them my Blu-ray services, but they don't have a home video agreement yet. It's just, it's weird. It's in limbo. But they're doing a limited theatrical run, so I hope everyone that, you know, wants to see it can. It looks amazing. I'll tweet after I see it. Cool. But I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, nice. That sounds good. I'll keep that in the back of my head. That sounds really interesting. All right, so we got some Twitter questions, but before we do that, we have some programming notes here. I mentioned this on Twitter, but I have not mentioned it on the show yet. So, a lot of people still asking about Revenge of the OOs, Revenge of the Aughts. It is, of course, still happening. But everyone involved basically just has been asking for more time, myself included, because we knew this was going to happen. It's just such a mountain of material to cover more so than the other decade shows, that we just needed more time. And as the dates sort of came and went, and people kept asking for more time, the closer we got to Christmas, the closer I realized, okay, so typically at Christmas we put out 2 2-hour episodes that count something down or something like that. We usually have some kind of a gimmick for those episodes. And in order to push this, the Revenge show, back into late fall, the closer we got to those Christmas episodes, and I realized we're not going to be able to do 8 hours worth of material for 1 month. And not only that, like, if we're doing a big countdown show, that's typically what the Christmas shows are anyway. So the Revenge of the Odds show has become the Christmas episodes. So you will get those installments over Christmas. We have decided on panelists, but I have not announced them yet. Please do not send me your top threes yet. I will be asking for those before we record. That will be in late November. But so that's what's going to happen. And in lieu of the Christmas episodes this year, you're going to get Revenge of the Odds. So,
sorry, guys.
Yeah. It's a lot of,
I'm kidding.
It's a
no,
lot of shit.
It'll be great shows.
It's a lot of shit. And people will be happy to get it, I'm sure, when it does.
It is so much. Although I am a little bit disappointed that we're not going to do the trading of stuff to watch this year. That was fun last year.
Well, we could still do that show.
Okay.
We can still do that, but that would be one episode. We wouldn't turn it into two. But yeah, we could totally still do that. Actually, that's a really good idea. We should we'll do that sometime over the holidays. Maybe that'll be the episode after the Revenge shows. But yeah, no, we could totally still do that. I'm going to write that down so I don't forget that we did that. All right, let's go ahead and take some Twitter questions here. We got a few.
Joke.
Just a couple this time. Okay, Bradley C. Meek, your friend of mine, asks, what do you guys think of short anime series like Puyo Puyo, Chi, and Butt Biting Bug? Chi, Sweet Home. So this is like the 5-minute episodes.
Okay. You're right.
I tend to not watch them.
The problem with them is they lend themselves to, like, quick gags and not anything actually engrossing.
Yeah. That format is basically suited for a comic strip format where setup, punchline, the end. I got a lot of other shit to watch. I don't got time for that.
Butt Biting Bug is meant for 4-year-olds, by the way.
Yeah.
That is not meant for not that ever stopped anime fans on any level, but
right.
just so you're not going into it expecting some cerebral experience.
Yeah, I don't know. Like that stuff.
It's literally adapted from a preschool song.
Well, I have yet to see a 5-minute show. Chi was cute. I watched a few of those, but I didn't have any desire to watch more than a few. And generally, I never hear anything like, oh, you got to see this amazing show. The episodes are only 5 minutes long, but it's totally worth it. Like, you never really hear that. It's always like, yeah, okay, I killed a Sunday afternoon with it. It was okay, I guess,
Puyo Puyo I do have to check out, though, because, Akitaro Daichi, Spherical Cat, that sounds like a good time.
Sure. Why not? All right. Someone who has asked to remain anonymous asked this question. He says, I'd like to know your opinion on the balance between avoiding piracy and maintaining a responsible budget. My own thought has always been that if I bought what my budget can afford, it doesn't matter how I obtain the rest of my media as long as I'm not financially supporting bootleggers, but maybe I'm rationalizing. Well, of course you're rationalizing.
Yeah, that doesn't really make sense.
It doesn't. I mean, yeah, okay, great, you're doing your part, you're buying stuff. The piracy debate, to me, at this point is over. Piracy won. And the only thing you can do now is if you really want to support the artists and entertainers who make the stuff you fill your time with, you pay them for their work. You don't have to, but you should.
Yeah, anything, it's a tithe at this point, and it's a measure of your own self-discipline, really.
Yeah, that's really what it boils down to. It's your own desire and your ability to compensate the people who entertain you. Piracy has made it so that you don't have to care about it at all. But I think you should, and I gleefully support the artists and entertainers that entertain me. At this point, what is even the purpose of arguing, oh, piracy's wrong? Yeah, well, But they won the they won. So what are you going to do?
You know, it's funny because in the larger entertainment world, the crackdown on piracy has gotten fairly strong to the point where it's actually more risky than it might be worth. But that hasn't happened with anime on any level.
I don't know that. I don't know that it's a huge risk to download a movie. You know, you might get a cease and desist in the mail from your ISP, but that's right. About it.
Okay, well, that's fair.
You know, they have been. It seems like they have been cracking down on bootleggers and stuff. That's where their real problem is, I think.
The torrent sites as well.
And the torrent sites, yeah, they've been taking that down. And, you know, frankly, like, if all those pirate sites disappeared tomorrow, I wouldn't shed a single tear.
No.
But I don't, you know, you're right. They have been shutting down a lot of the torrent sites, and that's good. They should do that. That's their right to do that. I don't know. Then you get into the obnoxious, well, if you just kill one, then another one will pop up. So, and then they never finish the sentence. The end of that sentence is, so don't do anything about piracy. Because if you kill one, another one will pop up. So just leave them all.
That's the thing, though. They're kind of not.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
There's been no replacement for Demonoid, really.
Yeah, no. And if Pirate Bay ever actually goes down, like, for good, which who knows if it will or not. But once that goes down, like, that's going to cut out people's ability to pirate shit so dramatically that I would wonder if that's the sort of thing that would seriously bring some revenue back. I don't know. But again, like, while I will sit here and state the reality that piracy won and that it's up to your self-discipline to decide whether or not you pay people who are entertaining you, I would not shed a single tear if all that shit got shut down. Like, good for them for actually taking them out. Yeah.
I would shed one tear for the stuff that I couldn't get any other way.
Yeah, well, see, the funny thing is that if Pirate Bay goes down, that has no impact on the anime industry.
Right, yeah.
Like, anime torrent sites, I don't think I've ever seen more than one go down or something like that.
Like, if they go down, it's for, like, hours.
Yeah, it's fucking ridiculous. That's that piracy in the world of anime is a bigger issue than it is at entertainment at large, even though entertainment at large treats it like the end of the world, which, you know, very well could be. It's such a bigger problem in the anime world. It's ridiculous. I'm surprised I've never seen any, like, in-depth articles on from outside our little circle of anime journalists going into, oh, well, but if you look at Japanese animation, the entire culture is consumed with piracy. Like, you know, outside of college kids, will you find a group of people who are more brazenly just downloading everything?
I doubt it.
I doubt that. But anyway, so, yeah. Buy what you can, man. That's all we can say. All right. A Robin Says Tweet asks, what were anime clubs like in the old days? Tell me a story,
Holy
Grandpa.
Holy shit, how old are we?
Not that old. We're old-timers in this crowd, but yeah, I you know, I have fond and not fond memories of anime clubs. I was going to an anime club, and I'm sure you were too, when you needed to go to an anime club to watch anime. And once digital fan subs started proliferating, everything changed completely. And people were no longer coming to the club to watch anime, they were coming to socialize. So the dynamic completely changed.
There was an excitement for me in... Honestly, I was never the guy sitting there watching stuff.
Yeah. No, me neither.
And, you know, most of the people that came were literally sitting there watching stuff. But I don't know. I'm very nostalgic about those days. That excitement, the smell of the library conference room, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there are definitely some fond memories. I was the guy providing the stuff. I was the one with the tape trading thing. I had the tape trading thing going on, and yeah, as everyone knows, so did you. So I was the one bringing stuff for everyone to watch, and there was always an excitement whenever we got something new in, and people were really excited to see it, or if, like, there was one really popular show, everyone would pile into the room to watch it, and it would be a collective viewing experience that you just don't get anymore with anime, like, at all.
Yeah. Mine had a lot of drama.
Yeah, there was drama in mine too, but
there always is, because we're talking about, you know, 15 to 20 year olds trying to do a club with various levels of dedication.
Yeah, mine was dominated by these guys who were way too old to be there. Like, they were all in their late 30s, and they were hanging out at a college anime club. And they had all gone to the college, and they had all been in the club when they were teenagers or when they were in their 20s, but they were still hanging around 10, 15 years later. And those guys were drama queens. I liked some of them, but they were drama queens. But it was kind of a weird dynamic.
We had a couple people that we had to kick out, a couple guys that were stealing tapes.
Oh, yeah.
Or like secretly providing them to groups that we had a grudge against or something like that.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, so I think the meanest thing we actually did to someone was he still lived at home, so we subscribed him to a bunch of gay porn magazines.
Oh, youth.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think back on those days with some measure of nostalgia. The only thing about it that I miss is the collective viewing experience. You know, everyone would just get so fucking excited when we would have new episodes of Escaflowne.
Right. Oh, that was the best.
Yeah, it was such a huge thing. And every time the episode ends, the audience just goes, oh, because I can't believe the cliffhanger. And yeah, like, sure, I miss that a lot. But that entire experience has been supplanted across all forms of media these days. Barring a big opening night of a big movie, collective viewing is just not really, doesn't really happen that often anymore. Clubs used to be relevant. Now they're not. I think my club still exists in some capacity. I haven't looked into it in a very long time, but I know as of a couple of years ago, someone told me they were still kicking around. Don't know what the hell they're doing, but they do still exist, apparently.
I haven't checked into my old club in years. Kodocha's obviously long, long, long gone, but yeah. My first club, Mana, might still be around. I can look them up.
Yeah, I don't think I would know anyone who's in the club now, but yeah, I don't know. Okay. Braves133 asks, what are your thoughts on Final Fantasy VII after replaying it recently? The game holds up. It's still really good. Still a lot of fun. Story's silly. But that game really still holds up very, very well. Everyone keeps asking them to remake it, and they keep saying if we remake that, it's because we need money so badly that we're willing to do it. The stories behind the remake of that game are very interesting insight into the inner workings of a video game company that has seen its fortunes fall over the years. It's still a really solid game. I really did enjoy going through it, and it's much shorter than I remember. I think we blew through it on the stream in like maybe 25 hours. It's also not very difficult. Anyway, still good. Okay. Andrew Paplu asks... Wait, nope, that's not really a question. Hang on. Okay, FireAxe428 asks, if you had to make a guess, how would you explain Sentai Filmworks' complete absence from the social media scene? That is a calculated and intentional thing. They do not really talk to fans outside of their panels, and that's it. And that's how they do damage control. That's how they sort of get away with really not having any of their decisions questioned or anything. It's just they're gonna put out what they're gonna put out. You're gonna like it or you're not gonna like it, but they're not gonna put themselves through the arduous task of dealing with you directly. The people that put that system into place do not work there anymore, but obviously they have kept that policy going, and I think it's working for them.
You know, when they were ADV, they made, frankly, a lot of questionable decisions based on fan feedback.
Yeah, no shit.
So I think not engaging is probably a really good idea.
Well, the other thing is in this day and age, and I think this is true for every company, in this day and age, the way the internet works, if you decide to engage, you basically just get to listen to people bitch you out 24 hours a day. Doesn't matter what decisions you make, you're going to be told that you're an idiot and you're doing it wrong nonstop all day long.
That was my favorite part of being the ombudsman for Central Park Media.
Really. If you had a choice where it's like, okay, well, they're going to buy our products. We are doing the best we can to make sure that they're getting what they want. But I really don't want to turn the bitch machine on. I really don't want to listen to fans tear me a new asshole over every little thing all day long, every day. So we're just not going to be on Facebook. We're just not going to go on Twitter. We're not going to take fan feedback unless we're at panels or unless you want to email us directly. But insofar as I know, like, they barely send out screeners or anything. They're just like, look, we do what we do. We stay quiet about it. We keep our heads down. We keep the lights on. We keep food on the table. It's smart. I think what Sensei's done is smart. And the fact that they're apparently thriving right now is just good news. So, good for them. I can't say that if I ran an anime distributor, I would necessarily want to go and be like, hey, fans, tell me what I'm doing wrong constantly. Like, I get that enough working at ANN.
I mean, you'll hear about it. It's not like you really need to solicit that feedback. If you really want to see what people are talking about, you just dip into the forums.
Yeah, find a review of your latest release, go look at the forum thread for it.
There's no need to actively engage.
Yeah, really. Yeah, okay. I mean, it would be bad if everyone did that. But I think for some companies, as a strategy, it does work. Okay. Rhetorical Noise asks, got kind of a long question here. He says, I know you two are both big film nerds. Given that the fact that anime is Japanese animation, I'm curious where you guys would feel more at home. A film festival dedicated to Japanese cinema or an animation festival? Let's say both film festivals have a really neat retrospective and screenings of rare films that are difficult to see otherwise. Interesting.
I want to go to both.
Yeah, I want to do both, but I have to admit, I would go to the animation festival first. That's my wheelhouse. If you're showing rare animated movies that I've never heard of or hadn't had a chance to see before, yeah, I'm all over that shit. Like,
that's a huge toss up for me because I'm a big fan of Japanese live action cinema as well.
Yeah, and for my part, like, I'll wait until you recommend something, but I tend to not seek it out on my own. So, yeah.
I think if you made me choose, I would probably have to, you know, douse myself in kerosene and
figure out a way to clone yourself.
Play the Buddhist monk circa 1976 card.
Sure. Tasteful. Yeah. No, I have to be honest, I would totally go to the cartoon festival first. But yeah, let's see here. Also from Rhetorical Noise, it says, really like the anime spotlight. Any chance A&M will ever cover anime films there, such as A Letter to Momo? We've been throwing this around and talking about doing it. The spotlight, as you can attest to, is already a tremendous amount of work and hassle, and I can imagine getting materials for a feature film would be more difficult? I don't know.
Yes, but there are a few things that would make it easier, and one big weird monkey wrench that I'm not sure how it would affect it. The things that make it easier is that, normally, be it a release by Toho or Shochiku or one of the major Japanese studios, is that if it's a film that's not, say, a Shonen Jump movie, if it's a film like Letter to Momo, they probably have a subtitled print, and they're probably prepping it for festivals.
Yeah.
So they have English synopses, they have stuff like that already together, whether it's together in time for the actual Japanese theatrical release date, who knows. That said, the whole raison d'etre of Spotlight is because American fans, most of those shows, they'll get a chance to see within a month or so. Like, it's coming. The reason for Spotlight is that we don't get any of the marketing paraphernalia months in advance the way they do in Japan, because they just don't have the rights in place yet. They just don't have it together.
Right.
With movies, who knows when we'll get it, if we get it.
Right, if at all, if ever, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, at best, I think even something like My Miracle, I don't think there's, like, barely fan subs floating around of that.
Yeah, it's kind of...
And that's a 3-year-old, 4-year-old movie.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird thing. Like, we hesitate to run reviews of, like, one-off screenings of, like, a subtitled theatrical film that has no distributor, no announced plan to be released here, because ultimately all you wind up doing is just frustrating the readers, because you're like, oh, this really great movie that I saw, the only time you'll ever get to see it. It's kind of like teasing them. It's telling them, oh, this product exists, but you don't get to see it.
Here you go. Just
yeah.
Kidding.
Yeah, yeah. Basically. It doesn't really serve much of a purpose. You know, people can't contextualize the review, they can't have their own opinion, they can only just read what you thought, and then that's it. I mean, imagine if American films were reviewed that way, where it's like, hey, this movie exists. There's no way for you to see it, but it exists. Which is kind of weird. Doesn't really serve much of a purpose. So, yeah. I think we have decided, I think at some point it was decided that we will eventually incorporate films and maybe OVAs into the full list, but Spotlight, who knows? It sounds like it's not outside the realm of possibility, but...
Yeah, I mean, we're having a tough enough time with the shows themselves, or with the TV series. I don't really know how we could work harder.
Yeah, yeah. We are getting to a point where our resources, in terms of just man hours, are a little tapped out.
Yeah, man. Yeah. When I'm doing Spotlight, that's pretty much a solid 2 weeks where I'm going at all cylinders. And Mitsuru, who's organizing thing in Japan, he's going on, you know, he's hiring, not hiring, but he's like running on fumes.
Yeah.
And we have a translator that's going nuts.
Right.
So between the three of us, we're dying already.
Well,
I'm not sure we could do more.
I wonder, I don't think people know this so much, but ANN is a skeleton crew. It is not a huge company. We don't have that many full-time employees. We don't have that many employees, period. It's a small crew of people producing everything you see on ANN. So when you see a big feature like that, it's usually one person killing themselves, one or two people killing themselves trying to get it together.
Yep.
If we had a bigger team, it would be nicer, but, you know, it's how we keep costs down. But yeah, so maybe some point in the future. All right, Silver Husky asks, I'd like your opinion on the entire debacle with Eurogamer. Could this happen to anime journalists? Did you see this?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so here's basically what happened is there's this games journalist who's very, very well known. Somebody wrote, I can't remember the site that wrote the article, but there's a shot of this games journalist with this sort of dead-eyed expression on his face sitting in a chair next to Halo 4 branded soda, like Mountain Dew and like Doritos and all this other stuff. And the article was basically like games journalists are basically shills who the games industry lavishes them with trips and swag and all kinds of shit. And in exchange, you know, video games are rated on a scale from 7 to 10, and they typically don't go below. Even mediocre games will get like 8.5 or whatever. That's a little overblown, but. This question eventually goes into, does the anime industry PR have a strong influence over some writers, or is this problem unique to games journalism? Here's the thing about this. The answer is real simple. There are billions of dollars in video games. There is not that kind of money in anime.
Yes, there are hundreds of dollars in anime.
There are hundreds of dollars and a very small press corps. Like, anime is not covered by that many people. And it's a business with really not that much money in it. So, you know, if the anime industry were the video games industry and it had billions of dollars to throw at critics and reviews of anime mattered as much to sales as reviews of video games matter to video games, and, you know, your opinion on video game reviews, like it or lump it, the industry treats those like they're win or lose, life or death. Your Metacritic score determines your sales, basically. Not in all cases, but in many cases, that Metacritic score is incredibly important to your sales. So reviews really matter there. So, of course, they're going to grease those pigs, metaphorically speaking. In the anime industry, the most elaborate thing we have seen from any PR effort has been Funimation's attempt to promote their Dragon Age movie, which was just a box of swag that came in the mail. And we haven't seen anything like that in years.
Yeah, not since Genion had a budget.
And yeah, now since Genion had a budget. And frankly, it's never gone past that. It's always just been like, hey, this thing's coming out. Critic, here's a box with a t-shirt in it and some posters and the DVD. And please give us a nice review. They don't actually request a nice review, but that's the implication when you get the box of swag. But that's just standard PR. I've never been plied or asked to give something a good review or even heavily criticized by my contacts at these companies to give something a good review. I've never had those kind of ethical problems. And you know, and nobody working at Anime News Network has had, at least nobody writing at Anime News Network, I don't know the entire history of the company, but nobody writing for us has ever been cajoled by a PR flack or anything like that. I mean, it's the separation is very clear and distinct, and I've never had someone really, really cross the line. You know, there's a lot of fantasies out there about, oh, everyone, every single critic is being paid off. No. There's no money for that.
Little ANN ancient history trivia. When I was, like, first starting the site and just trying to get recognition from the companies and just trying to get screeners, the first person who did was Sean Kleckner, and the first thing he sent me, cool devices.
Great.
C minuses across the board.
Right.
So, you know, are these people our friends? Yes. That's the closest thing I can think of to a conflict of interest. But honestly, they're all the kind of friends where you can go, hey, yeah, fuck you, you released some crap.
Yeah. Like, they... it's never been the understanding that because we're friendly with them at conventions and, you know, we might go out for drinks or something, that because that happens, I'm going to give Dragon Age a B+ or an A- or something. I gave that thing a D, and it deserved it.
If anything, we'll, once plied with liquor, we'll spend the night trying to get those people admitting that it's a crap product. That's how those nights usually go.
Yes, that does happen sometimes. There's no impetus on my part to be dishonest in a review so that I don't offend a PR contact. That is not in my head, and it's not in any of my critics' heads. And if it were, I would fire them. You're not supposed to do that. Just give your honest opinion. The video games industry is a different beast altogether, and that's because there's billions of dollars in it, and you can't really compare it to really anything else. I know the movie business can sometimes, you know, if you trash a bunch of Fox movies, I know they're really bad about that. They'll start banning you from screenings and stuff like that. But that's all how contentious and how draconian their particular PR firm is. It all boils down to that. There's no blanket statement you can make about this. And not every games critic is paid off. In fact, I don't know any that are. There are a lot of myths about video game critics, and I kind of wish some of them would actually speak up against a lot of those insinuations.
You know, I have to say, back in the swag days, I didn't want most of that shit.
No, these
were not welcome. You know, they can, you know, photograph me looking exhausted amongst a sea of cheap, you know, cheap branded apparel, but I don't want that crap.
Yeah, you're not going to wear it or put the poster up on your wall or whatever.
Now, you know, if you're a fanboy, you might, you know, throw yourself into a mosh pit for a t-shirt, but once you're a pro, you're just like, I don't want that. I have like 80 t-shirts.
I will say that I am 100% positive that there are hack anime critics out there who just give everything positive reviews because they assume if they give everything positive reviews, they'll keep getting screeners. So I don't doubt that there are hacks out there that just do it for the free anime. I don't know any of those people personally, so I couldn't tell you, like, this guy does that. I don't know anybody like that, but I'm positive that there are people like that. But I don't think they have a very big audience. I've certainly never heard of them. I don't doubt that those people exist. So it's not like it's a all or nothing thing, but, most of the major sites that you see reviewing anime, yeah, there's no influence, going on there. Unless you
when
just
someone won't say anything bad about anything ever, it's kind of self-evident.
Either they have such broad taste that you wonder why they're writing about entertainment media from an opinion standpoint in the first place, But it's more obvious that they want to stay in the free stuff. Don't read them then. don't partake. But anyway.
I don't think anyone has ever accused us of liking too many things.
Yeah, we don't have that problem. The opposite problem, in fact. Okay, final question. Rainy Isle asks, what are your thoughts on the new Dragon Ball Z movie in 2013? Will we be seeing it released in the States? Well, I mean, what do you think?
Direct-to-video, maybe.
Direct-to-video. It's not. I mean, well, who knows? Maybe Funimation will do like a Fathom Events thing or something like that. But I am sure that they are they're licking their chaps looking at that thing.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way they're not going to at least try to bring it out here. I would be shocked if it didn't come out.
Day and date, maybe.
Yeah, probably not day and date. I would say it's probably going to be a little bit, but...
It's hard to say. Toei, it's kind of a wild card.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, I mean, I don't have any... I don't care. I'm not a Dragon Ball fan, so I'm not going to watch it. It does kind of depend on what the film is about. If it's some kind of weird standalone story, or I have no idea even what it's about. So, but I'm not a Dragon Ball guy, so don't care. I don't know if you're the same way.
I am clearly a huge Dragon Ball guy.
Yeah, right. You have all those Goku silk shirts in your...
Zach, that was supposed to be a secret.
Dang it. Sorry. Okay, well, that wraps up the first segment. Let's do a call-out show. Okay, first up, we are talking to Buck out in New York. How's it going, Buck?
It's going good, Zach.
What's on your mind, man?
Well, let's talk about how certain properties that are made in Japan don't do well there, but do well in the States, and vice versa in that regard.
Right. Any particular... I mean, there's the obvious examples that everybody always brings up, but they're all from the late 90s. I'm certain...
Yeah, that just it does seem a lot of late 90s stuff definitely falls on the list. Probably one of the best examples is Bakano.
Yeah, that did somewhat better here, I think, than it did in the States. I don't think it was a huge blockbuster here, but...
No, it wasn't, because it's not a lot... Take in. It's only 16 episodes
right.
In total, and 13 that made it there on television, but it bombed in Japan, whereas at least it was a success and considered very good here.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if you were to point to a show where I would say, okay, well, this is much more of a Western sensibility anyway, like, that's one of them, and it does kind of boil down to the sensibility of the show.
Oh, definitely.
It seems to me that, you know, mostly what's going to hit over here with a mainstream audience, and I don't mean insular, you know, anime fandom. I mean people who maybe are not hardcore anime fans. It's, you know, sort of dark, maybe not necessarily dark, but action shows where the focus is the action, not the cute girls or the hilarious slice of life comedy or whatever. Like, those shows do okay, but in terms of success here, like, the Western sensibility seems to be... you know, action shows that are somewhat violent, that kind of a thing. Closer right. to a Western graphic novel aesthetic than anything else.
True. I mean, a great example is Cowboy Bebop. I mean, yeah. Not to say it wasn't big in Japan, but over here it's considered a classic, an all-time classic.
It was nowhere near as successful in Japan as it was here. It was a massive hit here. It was not a massive hit in Japan.
I mean, I'm saying it was popular. I mean, it's not saying that it wasn't considered a classic level. It's that over here it sort of has this high up on the pedestal type of feel.
Yep. Over here it's... I mean, I routinely see it when people do, like, the top 50, you know, television cartoons of all time. They usually put Cowboy Bebop on there somewhere near the top. It's always...
Not only that, but... One thing it does get, it's even on people's list of top action cartoons and stuff like that
yep.
that don't watch anime, which obviously speaks volumes to its sort of gateway drug title as well.
Yeah, that's true. The thing about those shows is we desperately need another one of them. There hasn't been one in a while.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that happened in anime that I can remember was Code Geass a few years back.
Yeah, I feel like that never really broke out of just anime fans.
It didn't break out, but that's the biggest thing that really made any real noise that I can remember.
I guess. I don't know what you consider noise.
Well, I do live on the internet.
Right, yeah, that's one thing you have to be really careful about. Like, I have found that people's perception of what's actually popular and what's actually successful is deeply skewed by the internet.
Yeah, I don't pretend to hide it, but I try to keep honest, so...
Right, yeah. No, it's a good point. It's, There's a distinct lack of shows like that coming out. And, you know, it's because they don't make a lot of money in Japan. And there's no guarantee that they're going to be huge here. And there hasn't been a huge hit here. So I think that's why we're getting fewer of them.
Yeah, it's definitely been... It's definitely not 2003 anymore.
No, it is not. What would you like to see? Do you want more of those shows? Do you feel like they're not producing enough of them? Like, what's your take on this?
Well, to me, I'm always a guy who, in the bottom line, quality prevails, and if it piques my interest, I'm going to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's me personally. I think part of the reason why stuff hasn't been coming out, it's just that when I think of the really good stuff, I think, you know, stuff that did well over here, stuff like Death Note and... Fullmetal Alchemist did really well.
Mm-hmm.
It's I guess some of them have sort of a feel that they're not. I hope it doesn't come off slightly xenophobic when you dig into it. But it's sort of the idea of it's not really that Japanese.
Sure. No, you're making a really common point in that, like, you can look at Cowboy Bebop and it has elements of anime in it, but it's not particularly steeped or rooted in Japanese culture. You don't need to know anything about Japanese culture to appreciate that show. And sure, I don't think it's a xenophobic to make the observation that shows that are not particularly swimming around in Japanese culture tend to hit more over here. I mean, all the ones you just listed,
right?
You know, Fullmetal Alchemist. You don't really need to know about anime to enjoy that show. It's not a bunch
that is
of
definitely true.
It isn't a bunch of the same elements that get loaded into really heavily targeted at otaku anime.
Right.
So I don't necessarily think that's a xenophobic observation to make. It's just the truth. Like, shows that are a little less culturally distinct tend to hit a little bit more over here. But, yeah, no, that's totally a reasonable thing to say.
True. One thing I did find fascinating, though, is that even certain movies that sort of are cult classics in Japan have been, or even shows, for that matter, that have done well over here. I mean, as far as I know, I've not heard much about how well Japan... It did well in Japan, but I hear Fooly Cooly did much better in the United States due to its constant runs on Adult Swim.
Yeah, it did. It did do much better here. It sold very, very well. The reruns were always pretty high rated on Cartoon Network when they ran it into the ground, so to speak.
That's Cartoon Network for you. Runs it into the ground and back.
Yeah. Well, there's a thing. There were like, you know, 5 or 6 years there where. There were a lot of huge things coming out of Japan, and the stuff was hitting really hard here, and that just stopped. It just doesn't happen anymore.
I think part of it is that we got used to it.
Well, how do you mean?
Well, it's sort of, when anime first sort of hit in the early 90s, we were getting, you know, the schlock titles, we were getting stuff like Mad Bull 34, Angel Cop, Geno Cyber...
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we're getting the bottom of the barrel. And then by probably the late 90s, early 2000s, we started getting stuff like Cowboy Bebop, Dragon Ball Z, which, speaking of, run into the ground.
Yeah. I mean, well, I'm not sure I agree with your premise here. In the 80s, we were getting a few of the violent OVAs and stuff like that, and we
right.
got... Kira and all those Vampire Hunter D, that kind of thing. But the market for anime didn't really blow up until the early 2000s, and that's when we started getting everything. So we ran through decades and decades of material, getting the best of the best. Then we started getting the mediocre, and then we started getting basically everything. And now sort of... And now streaming has taken that over, so now we are literally almost getting basically everything that runs on TV in Japan. And so we had a few years there. In those specific years, we were suddenly getting the cream of the crop. So say like you say, okay, I'm going to suddenly start reading romance novels. So you go through 50 years worth of romance novels and you pick the top 10, you're going to get the best stuff. And that's kind of what happened in the beginning of the 2000s.
Yeah, that was definitely true.
We were sort of cherry picking it. And then as the market expanded and more players came in and more people were licensing things and releasing things, by its very nature, you know, the barrel started to empty and you started getting closer to the bottom. And, yeah, that's kind of what happened back then. And you know, when we say, like, oh, there hasn't been a hit, well, you know, we're current with Japan now. So,
yeah,
unless they produce something, we're not going to get it. There's no more 20, 25, 30 years worth of stuff to sift through and find the gems.
That is definitely very true.
So, yeah, that's kind of a problem.
I think what has really happened is not only have we caught up, it's a sort of, you know, we're the group that, you know, we're the guy who had the friend who's seen like 30 years of a show, and then we went in, watched all of it, like binged on it, and then now we're catching up and the season's not that good.
Well, I don't know. You know, that's a little bit of an exaggeration. Like, every season, there are at least two shows... I've found at least two shows, which is pretty good, that you're talking 8 TV shows a year that I'm willing to say, okay, this looks like it's totally worth my time, and I'll sit down and watch it. And that's actually not a bad hit ratio in terms of just something that would, you know, that I find personally interesting. That's not that bad. You know, for every single season, there's at least two shows. I think that's pretty good, considering the diversity of material that they're putting out. It's not that bad. I feel like it's not as though now that we're caught up, we're just sort of sitting around sifting through all this junk. It's that now that we're caught up...
Oh, of course. I completely agree with you. Get at least one or two good shows a year, which is definitely a good ratio, considering how bad you could honestly get.
Yeah, well, of course there's going to be a lot of junk. I mean, if you were to take American television and watch everything on it, like everything in a particular genre, so I'm going to watch all American cop shows, which is basically sort of what we're doing. We're watching all Japanese animation. So if you picked every single cop show, what are the odds that you're going to like more? You're going to want to watch and like more than two or three of them just as a consumer? Probably not great, unless you just your diversity, your taste is so broad that you'll basically watch anything. And there's nothing wrong with that. I don't know how people find the time for it.
Obviously,
but,
I mean...
I've
had the time for that.
Yeah, you know, some people... it's funny that the guys who watch, like, you know, oh, I'm following 27 anime this season, and you're like, holy hell, how do you do that? And they're like, well, it's only 3 hours a night. And it's like, well, what else do you do in your free time? Well, I guess nothing. Like, 3 hours a night, that's
your
evening.
I saw Summer Wars this week, which was fun.
Real keeping up with the fresh releases there.
I'm not in college, so that was we have a single day where we have about 10 to 12 hours worth of anime watching / Japanese cinema.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things that came up, and I was surprised how well it went over. I mean, I hadn't seen it yet, so...
It's a crowd pleaser.
Sorry, what was that?
It's a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, it is. It's very enjoyable, and it's really funny how it is the first Digimon movie rehashed.
Yeah, you know, everybody brings that up. It's so overblown to me. Like, that's so overblown. Like, yeah, okay, the plot's similar. Like,
yeah,
but it's a completely different film.
It's the same plot, but it's a completely different way of looking at it, so...
All right. I mean, so we have directors that repeat themselves constantly here, so... I'm so... Like, every time Summer Wars comes up, someone's gonna go, well, what about Digimon? It's like, oh, can we just talk about Summer Wars? Like... Yes, okay, there's a Digimon movie that's similar. Like, we don't have to just focus on that. Like, the conversation about Summer Wars never seems to get past Digimon.
I don't know. That is something that's really upsetting, and I think that happens to a lot of other movies that are very similar. Like, when the Hunger Games come out, everyone was talking about how it was similar to Battle Royale.
Which it's not.
It's
really
not.
It's that they share, like... wafer thin premise. If you boil the premise down to like a really obtuse, vague description of the film, yes, they'll sound similar. But I don't know anyone who's seen both of those movies and goes, "Oh yeah, it's just the same thing." It's totally not. First of all, Battle Royale is a much better film.
I can't speak too much. I was going to see it Monday, but I had a business to do during that 2.5 hours where the director's cut was shown.
Right.
Which is funny because it's my movie as well, so it's basically on my fault that it hasn't come out yet.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, so I guess that's about it.
Good. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed Summer Wars, and we'll all keep an eye out for the next show that might actually have a chance at being a hit here in the States. But it was good talking to you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah. Anytime, Zach. Anytime.
Okay. Now we're going to talk to another returning champion from the Land of Obscusion blog. It's George. How's it going, George?
Hey, how you doing, Zach?
I'm doing. So what's up, man? What's on your mind?
Well, one thing like that kind of always gets me curious whenever I read forums about when certain titles. In this case, I almost have to be a little warned ahead of time. You might lose like half of your listeners with this. I'm going to be talking about sports anime, so
right, yeah, it's fine. Yeah, right? We've talked about it before on the show.
Yeah. Well, the main thing I seem to see a lot. It's kind of hard to say exactly why sports anime hasn't been so successful here, but aside from that, one thing I usually see is there's almost like a way of thought that almost makes me like confused at times that for some reason, when it comes to sports anime for the most part, the realistic one, the ones that handle the sports realistically, seem to be inherently better than the ones that go for the over-the-top, the crazy style. And I kind of honestly have to disagree with that. I almost kind of wonder, like, why is it with sports anime, it has to be, in a lot of people's minds, it has to be real to be good.
Right. So you're making sort of a distinction between realistic sports anime, of which there is not much, and then dramatic over-the-top sports anime. Like, let's get an example of each here, if you've got one.
Oh, yeah, sure. The way I could see it is, let's say, tennis anime. You have the Prince of Tennis, which is completely over-the-top. You know, anyone can see that. And on the other side of the coin, you have something like Aim for the Ace, which, from what I can tell, it's a little more realistic. Maybe it's not 100%, but it's more realistic, and it's definitely more about the character drama.
Sure. Right. I would argue probably something like Touch would be considered more realistic.
Yeah, the thing with baseball is there aren't really too many animes out there that go for like the over-the-top. The closest I ever saw was not even an anime itself. It was a live-action J-drama, but based on a manga from the 70s, Team Astro, or Astro Kyudan. And I saw it was legally streaming. I checked it out. That is probably the only baseball title I've seen that has truly gone for like the over-the-top style. Usually with baseball, that's a little more about like the game, the rules, the characters.
Right. So do you think sports that are more exotic to Japan get the more over-the-top treatment? So like an Ice Shield 21 or something like that?
No, it's... The weird thing I just really found is that some people seem to have this... I've seen this mentioned so many times that it's like when it's a sport, since sports are so ingrained in realism in real life, that when it's done in anime, if it's real, then that's the best way to do it. Because if it's over the top, it almost seems like the general thought is the person who creates a sports anime or a manga that's over the top doesn't seem to either understand the rules of the sport or doesn't seem to have the same love for the sport as like a Mitsuru Adachi does. And I honestly think that's completely, you know, bull. That's 100% false, because I would never say that like Masami Kurumada, you know, doesn't truly love boxing when he did Ring Nikaketa 1, which is completely over the top. But at the same time, you know, it's over the top, but you can tell he has a true love for the sport, and it's actually been documented that Kurumada loves, you know, contact sports like boxing, MMA, wrestling. He has friends in those sports, and he created the manga as an homage to Ashita no Joe, which is probably one of the more realistic styles for the most part, because that deals more with character drama than just outright crazy action.
Right. Yeah, I've never actually seen that. I've never seen that attitude where if this sports anime is over the top, then that means the creator doesn't care about the sport or doesn't understand it or doesn't know the rules or whatever. That to me is willfully ignoring the fact that this is an entertainment product and that there are editorial standards for entertainment product. And if the editor wants, hey, this boxing manga is neat and all, but you need to give it some fantastical elements in order to move books, that's going to happen. And not only that, but that seems like total bullshit to me. If just because it's got some crazy over-the-topness in it, that means the author doesn't know the sport? That's very silly.
I mentioned it's definitely an extreme case. That's probably the extreme case. But it really just comes down a lot where it's the over-the-top stuff is generally thought of as, you know, just inherently it can't be as good as the realistic stuff, which I can understand some of the logic behind that, but to me, they're just two halves of the same coin. They're pretty much both doing the same thing, but in different ways. It's like saying heads is better than tails inherently. It's just ridiculous to me.
The only thing that I would say where I could probably get behind that is that I feel like we're just saying the phrase over the top over and over and over again here, but if it's too over the top, it will remove tension from the game. And a lot of the appeal of sports anime is the tension inherent in the game. And if it's all magic powers, you know, they have magic powers and they're playing hockey, well, you know, the tension's kind of removed. Because it's not really hockey, it's something else. You know, it's magic hockey. So I could see that complaint, like, if it's just too much and it's just taking the tension out of the game. Sure, that can impact the narrative, that can impact your enjoyment. But just it's like, okay, this is an ironclad rule. If they get crazy, it's not good anymore. That just seems like someone's weird personal hang-up.
True. I mean, on that token, when you say it loses some of the drama and everything, I kind of would argue against that, because when you get to the over-the-top stuff, you're getting something unpredictable. You never know what could happen next. And it's not always magical powers or anything. It's sometimes just heavily exaggerated. You know, it still follows, like, some, you know, the rules of physics to a point, but it's just exaggerated physics. I think when Ring Kaketo 1 was being serialized, I think the term some Japanese people, when I read, they called it FF boxing, sci-fi boxing, which I think that probably makes a lot more sense than magical powers. But, yeah. But when I look at the over-the-top stuff, all right, I want to stop using that term, too. The exaggerated stuff.
Yeah.
The part of the fun is you don't know what's going to happen next. It's not just in the game itself, but it's just you don't know, you know, what can this person do? What can this person do? What each character can do? You want to figure it out. You want to see what happens next. It kind of, if anything, it might remove some element, but replaces it with a different element that you can't expect.
Sure. Sure. I can get behind that. I do find it sort of amusing that in a genre that, and of course this happens, but in a genre that is as ignored and has such a small fan base within the fan base as sports anime, that you get people in that tiny, tiny little niche that are really snobby about what's good and what's not, or what's valid and what's not in terms of sports anime. Like, I would imagine that, you know, you get so little of it that people would be a little less picky about what it is they want out of a sports anime. But I don't know, maybe that's naive.
over here, yeah, I agree with that. Whenever it comes over here, like, we got you know, that's boxing OVA, Joe versus Joe from the Japan anime under the name Anime Who. It was maybe above average at best, but I'll take it. I'll take what we get. It was okay. It wasn't anything special, but you know what? I'll take it. And that was probably on the more realistic end of the spectrum.
Well, I'm not even talking, like, if you're just sticking to legal releases. If you're just pirating the shit out of everything, you don't get that much sports anime. Very little of it is actually produced. Like, maybe one or two shows a year, and that's it. Like, tops.
Yeah, for anime, it's definitely more of a niche. The manga, it's crazy, but...
Sure, yeah.
I mean, it's not to say, like, I don't... just so people don't misunderstand, it's not to say that I am thinking the opposite, like I said. Realism and exaggerated, they're just two sides of the same coin. Some of my favorite anime, not just sports, but some of my favorite anime are realistic titles, like One Out, which does an amazing job adding in a psychological element, and it's pretty much all realistic. Another favorite of mine within the past maybe 5 or 6 years I've seen was, and I'm sure almost no one's going to understand this, maybe you might have heard the title, it's Monkey Turn, which is about hydro boat racing. that was, when I watched it, I was like, oh, okay, I'll watch it because it was, it's something different. And that ended up being one of the best paced, like, it was, I could see why the original manga tied with Hikaru no Go for the Shogakukan Shonen Award for manga back in 99. It was that good. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, no one really knows about it.
Yeah. Well, you are all about the obscure stuff, as we know.
True.
All right. Well, anything else on this subject, or?
Well, the other thing is, you have the people that do feel that the realism, it has to be better. The other thing that kind of gets to me is when the people feel that just being exaggerated, just being over the top, it means it's a parody. I really don't get that logic, because I can understand maybe people having fun with the idea or laughing at something, but that doesn't make it a parody. There's no satire. There's no making fun of. Maybe there's a couple of jabs here and there at some elements, but it's not making fun of the sport. It's not making fun of another title.
Yeah, you know what? I've found, like, among anime fans in general, the tendency to mislabel things as parody or satire is, it's noticeable. Just because something has elements of comedy in it does not mean it is satirizing a genre or a trope or whatever. But people do that all the time. The people will take, like, if the show's just straight up bad, people will defend it as it's intentionally bad. And it's as though, like, no bad shows ever get produced and everything is intentional.
Well, some shows are so bad that they're good. But, yeah, again, that might not be intentional.
No, but to people mislabel things as parody all the time. Even when it's clearly intended to be sincere and it's just a bad show, people will be like, oh, it's parody. It's supposed to be like that. It's like, you can tell when something is a parody. Like, there are markers that will show you, like, when something is tongue-in-cheek, when something is being satirical.
Exactly.
You know, but people mislabel stuff as parody all the time. Like, I can't even imagine if you're watching, like, a sports show that's really, really exaggerated. Like, it would be obvious if that were supposed to be a parody of sports as a genre. Like,
the only sports title I can think of that is over the top and meant to be a parody, the only one that really comes to my mind is Blazing Transfer Student. Because that is so obviously meant to satirize, but it's satirizing with love. Like, when the main character, Takizawa, decides, he's going to figure out a special move to defeat his opponent, and when he finally gets the move, and he wants to deliver it, he can never get the move off, simply because the name of his attack, the Takizawa Railway Punch, is too long, so his opponent gets his Sachu Punch off. That's hilarious! I love that element! But you can tell they're treating it seriously, and you can tell it's done with love, and that is a satire.
Sure, right.
It's not like when, in Ring a Kettle, when they're like, when there's visual accentuation going on, when, you're seeing stuff on screen, but it's not actually there. It's just there to accentuate the moment. I think a lot of people kind of lose that element, too. They don't seem to realize what's actually there and what's just an accentuation of something awesome.
Yeah. I don't know. I think you're right. I think that, but that definitely falls into the whole, everything bad is intentionally bad, and it's all intentional satire and parody, which a lot of people have that attitude, and it's not accurate. It is not an accurate analysis of what they're watching. Frustrating to see that. I get frustrated with it anyway.
I mean, probably the most recent example of someone taking the idea of, it's a parody too far is what happened recently in relation to the creator of Kuroko's Basketball. That one anti-fan, I guess you could say, that was sending powder and threatening to do drugs and, to send drugs to people because Kuroko's a popular title. That's where it stopped being, like, amusing to me, and that just made me just go, like, dude, what the hell?
Yeah, well, there's crazy people everywhere, and the internet gives them a voice.
And supposedly he's a slam dunk fan. I mean, I've read some slam dunk. It's awesome. And that is definitely one of the most realistic ones I can think of. People would like to say Hajime no Ippo is super realistic. It's not. It's not super exaggerated, but it's not realistic. But I can understand maybe this guy's complaint to a point, because Slam Dunk, before Kuroko, Slam Dunk was pretty much the only basketball manga that really was known. And now there's this other one that's essentially the other side of the coin. So I can understand if the guy doesn't like it because it's over the top in elements, but there's no reason to go psycho like he did. That, and almost in a sense, like the way people think it's a parody, that's, they're almost the ones being over the top about handling it this way, because to them, it's only this, and they're going to like almost ridiculous ways to justify that idea.
All right. Well, okay, man. Well, thanks a lot for coming on.
No, thanks. No problem. Thanks for having me.
Okay, up next we're talking to Greg, actually returning champion. He's been on a panel discussion we had a little while ago, but thanks for coming back, Greg.
Yes, thanks for having me.
No problem.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, you're in Japan, right?
Yes, I live in Japan right now. I live in a little suburb outside of Tokyo, and right now it's like dawn in Japan, and you know, it looks very romantic. It looks like an anime, almost, and you know, that's why I'm on the Anime News Network podcast.
Yeah.
Not really.
Sure. Okay, anyway, what's on your mind, buddy?
Yes, I just wanted to talk about some Japanese music that I like, because I think when there's lots of people in the United States who like Japanese music, it's, you know, it's one of a few things. It's either like sort of idol stuff, like, you know, AKB48, which I'm not particularly a fan of, and sort of kind of similar to that, like the Seiyu idol stuff, and which I'm not fond of either. And then the kind of the J-rock stuff, which the kind of, you know, I'm okay on that. But what I want to talk about is stuff that's kind of maybe a bit unknown or kind of underground to people both in Japan and in the United States. And so I just want to introduce a couple bands that I like quickly and one band that I really like in long form.
Okay, well, I'm curious to hear I'm curious to hear about it.
Yes, and there's also a short anime connection, so don't worry.
It's okay. Fine.
So, yes, I guess I'll start with the more well-known and work my way down to the absolute bottom of obscurity. I guess as far as idols go, like I said, I'm not a big fan of idols, but I do like Perfume. Do you know Perfume?
I am not a Japanese music aficionado.
Okay.
I tend to not really listen to much of it at all, actually. So I'm you know, I'll take these as recommendations of things I should check out, but the odds that I've heard of, I mean, I've heard of Perfume. I've never heard the music or anything like that. So, yeah.
Okay, so like Perfume is just they're like three girls. They're from Hiroshima, and they're sort of. They just got started as, like, a bunch of girls who wanted to sing and dance, and they were picked up. And the reason why I like them is because I don't really like... Like, the three girls themselves are all right, but I like their producer, Nakata Yasutaka. He is a... he's very good at what he does. He makes very good electronic music, and I like them, and, you know, I don't have to tell people to listen to Kyari Pamyu Pamyu. He produces her also. I like Kyari also. And what I probably should tell people to listen to is the group that he produced very first from basically when he was in high school all the way up to today called Capsule, which is right now they kind of do like kind of boring club-ish music. But in the past they did kind of really like solid electronic pop music. And there's a ton of albums and there's a bunch of stuff to listen to. So I think you should check Capsule out. And he's also done lots of soundtracks. He's done the soundtrack for the drama Liar Game, which was a manga also. And there was an anime that I think Sentai released it called Noregeki. It's like some weird 3D OVA that I haven't seen. But he did the soundtrack for that too. And he's a really cool guy. He does these parties in Shibuya, which I've gone to a few. And everyone there, like, it's like a club, but everyone I talk to is like an otaku. It's very strange. Like, I think Nakata kind of has, like, a weird otaku following. Like, not, like, anime otaku, but, like, weird music otaku. But it's just everyone there is just, like, kind of weird and otaku-y. It's very strange.
Interesting.
Yes. But yeah, I don't really need to tell people to listen to Perfume because everyone... Not everyone, but there's... And they're kind of well-known. They were in Cars, too! Wasn't that a great movie?
Oh, God. Yeah, that's probably where I heard them, come to think of it, unfortunately.
I've actually never seen Cars 1 or Cars 2, but...
Lucky you.
Yeah. My cousins like it. They're 5 years old. They love it. But anyway.
Anyway.
So yeah, the next group I want to talk about, like, the first ones are going to be very quick, so I'm just going to sort of bang through these.
Sure.
Pizzicato 5. Have you heard of Pizzicato 5?
Yeah, everybody has.
They actually came out in the States, so they were kind of popular in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
in kind of amongst I guess pretentious folks such as myself in the 90s,
right.
Both in America and in Japan. I think probably people these days probably don't really know about them that much, especially people my age, but since I'm like an old man mentally, I like them. The guy who does Pizzicato 5, his name is Yasuharu Konishi, and the vocalist is Maki Nomiya. Their music is very interesting because Konishi Yasuharu, he really likes old American pop culture and like old American music. So his music, it's in the mold of Japanese pop, but its influences draw on stuff that I like, which are sort of like, you know, 1970s sort of like funk music, you know, 1960s music, just sort of like this old American pop culture that I kind of grew up on because my family likes old things and I was really into that when I was a kid. And so it's there's a very interesting cut to that music, which is different from a lot of the Japanese pop that came out in the 90s. And a lot of the lyrics, they're kind of about, you know, they're pretty pop music things, like, you know, falling in love, falling out of love, but also songs about just being a cool guy, you know, listening to cool records, going to parties and stuff. It's, you know, it's kind of really, you know, it's, I guess it's kind of snobby, but I think their music is quite good if you kind of like, you know, old American stuff sort of remixed, you know, by a Japanese dude who's obsessed with the stuff. And there's really kind of like, since that guy, Yasaru, he loves sort of like old romantic movies. So to some of the lyrics, there's like, well, lots of pop music is sort of kind of, I don't know, it's not really genuine with, I think, feelings like that. I think a lot of his stuff, there's like sort of like a classic flavor to it, I should say. If you can understand Japanese, that is, which I can kind of understand because I live here.
Right.
And if you want to listen to them, Matador in the United States, they released some albums. Happy End of the World is pretty good. It's more of a dance album than filled with singles. And if you're like in Book Off in New York, they will definitely have their best of albums, which are called Big Hits and Jet Lags. There's three of them that cover different periods of time. That's probably the best way to listen to them because they have a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like trying to watch Gundam, and you don't know where to start. Like, when I first listened to Pizzicato 5, I downloaded like 500 songs, and not 5, like 200 songs, and I had no idea where to start. And there's lots of duds, that's true, but so you should start with the best of stuff and sort of figure out what you like, what you don't like. So go ahead, listen to Pizzicato 5. They're really old, so you can get their CDs really cheap if you're like in New York at Book Off or something. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool.
And,
I said cool.
So the next band is a band called Sotaisei Didon,
mm-hmm.
which is a Japanese word that means the theory of relativity.
Okay.
So as you can tell from their name, they're kind of another sort of band for pretentious jerks, mm-hmm. such as myself. I actually heard about them because the vocalist, Yakushimaru Etsuko, did the opening theme song for a couple of anime by a studio which you might know, called Studio Shaft,
mm-hmm.
famous for Bakemonogatari, Sayonara Zetsubou Sensei, and a show that I don't really like called Madoka Magica. Sorry, Zach.
Right, yeah.
And I kind of heard about them through Shaft. And actually, just going off on a tangent a bit, Shaft is very interesting because a lot of their shows have, they get really good musical talent for their openings.
Mm-hmm.
At least before they sold out. And and the band I'm going to talk about at the end is also one I heard about through Shaft. They get lots of really kind of maybe used to be famous acts or kind of sort of underground, like people like Otsuki Kenji. He did the Zetsubou Sensei openings. He's kind of like this crazy old rocker that's been at it for a while. There's a band called Shinsei Kamate-chan, which is kind of like this weird band. The guy, the vocalist, dropped out of junior high school, and I think the band may actually be like canceled because he had sex with a junior high school girl. which is
classy.
Not, yeah, but they did the theme song to the show Dempa Onna Toseishu no Otoko. So basically, they get lots of interesting music talent. And so Taisei Riran, a lot of their songs are very mysterious. They love science fiction. They love science, as per their name. And they just love being weird. At their shows, they don't acknowledge the audience. Like, the vocalist will check her email on stage.
Okay.
Stuff like that. I've never been to one of their shows, because honestly, that doesn't really sound like an experience I'd be into, but apparently it's very bizarre. I think they kind of have their heads up their asses a little bit, but their music is solid. They have three albums, which, again, also have, like, sort of up their ass names, I guess.
Right.
Their first album is called, going by the English translation that they came up with themselves, it's called, Chiffon Capitalism.
Okay.
So in the cover is like an astronaut in space, and instead of a moon, it's a disco ball. But yeah, their music is kind of it's like mellow rock, and the vocalist she has a cute voice, but it's not like moe cute. It's like really sort of relaxed. It kind of flows like water, you know. When she does her anime song stuff, they kind of make her out to be a bit more cuter. So I'm not really a big fan of that sort of thing.
Right.
But a lot of their lyrics are quite strange, so strange that I can't really translate them very well, because like I said, there's lots of science fiction references. I'm pretty sure there's a Dragon Ball reference somewhere in one of their songs. They talk about Android 18 in one of their lyrics.
So is this stuff considered, I mean, I know you said that the singer sang some anime theme songs.
Yeah.
But is this stuff considered indie in Japan? Is that a thing there?
Yeah, oh yeah, Japan definitely has indies acts. I went to an indie show once, but as far as Sotaisei Riran and some of the other stuff I talked about, they're on professional labels,
right?
But they're not popular.
So it's kind of like Fox Searchlight. Like, it's 20th Century Fox, but it's their indie shingle, and they release all of their weird sort of limited audience kind of art movies and stuff like that.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Not technically indie, but the audience is definitely indie.
Yeah, and the next band I'm going to talk about after this, probably for a longer time, is exactly that sort of thing. But yeah, so Taisei Riran, actually, I think since they've kind of gotten a bit more popular, I met a guy, and he actually went to one of their shows, and it sold out pretty quickly. And the tickets were quite pricey, about 7,000 yen. So I think they've found a pretty strong and dedicated audience, but I've heard that the band members basically all changed, even the band leader, so I'm not really hot about seeing them live at this point.
Wow, okay, interesting.
Yeah. But you should definitely check them out. If you just type Sotaisei Riran into YouTube, something will pop up.
I'm sure.
And so the last band I want to talk about and is a band that is close to my heart. My Twitter followers should know, because I get really drunk a lot of the time and talk about them a lot.
Okay.
Almost every night, because if I'm not outside drinking with people, I'm by myself drinking, because I'm an alcoholic. But that has nothing to do with anything.
Okay, dude.
this band is called Omokage Lucky Hole. And as you can maybe tell from the title, they're kind of a dirty band.
Okay.
And actually, I heard about them because they did the theme song for, like I said, another show by Shaft called Natsu no Arashi, which, have you heard of that show?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's not very, very popular. It kind of bombed over here. Well, not really. It wasn't really trying to be popular, but it's just it's kind of a weird show by the guy who made School Rumble. And they did the opening for the first season, and I had never heard of this band before. And I heard the theme song, and it was, like, really great. You know, it sounds really 1970s, you know, kind of funky, you know, big, you know, great use of, like, horns and stuff, nice, funky bass line. And I had no idea what they were saying. And turns out the title for that Natsu no Arashi song is called Atashi Dake ni Kakete, or Sprinkle It Only on Me. I'm not going to really say what it's talking about sprinkling, but
okay.
That's I don't know how that song became an anime theme song. But basically, so let me just start with the origin of the name, Omokage Lucky Hole, so you can kind of get an idea of what kind of band this is. Omokage, so that just means sort of visage, that's what that word means, but Omokage Ichigo was the first Dutch wife to ever be sold in Japan. So that's where the Omokage part comes from. And Lucky Hole in Shinjuku a long time ago, back when it was a city of sin, and it still kind of is, but it's kind of like Times Square. You know, Times Square used to be really bad, but now it's kind of cleaned up.
Right.
Shinjuku is still pretty bad, but it's like not as crazy as it was in like the 80s. But a Lucky Hole were like there were holes, and if you were lucky, it was a woman. But if you weren't, it was like something else that wasn't a woman. So that's where their name comes from. So they're kind of dirty, but they're not just a bunch of perverts. A lot of their songs are really biting and unpleasant commentaries on Japanese society.
Hmm.
Or really unpleasant commentaries on kind of humans and sort of, you know, kind of the bad things. Essentially, their songs are about the sad relationships between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also, like I said, a bit of sort of social commentary that comes with that. And sometimes their songs are just dirty. So they're kind of like half, like sort of, like on one hand, they're kind of like this novelty band. On the other hand, they have serious things to say. And somewhere in the middle, they say it with a really, really like tongue pressed firmly in the cheek snark.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's really dark stuff. It's whenever I talk about this to Japanese people and have it listened to them, they're like, there's no way this band would ever sell in this country. Their stuff is too straightforward. It's Japanese people don't like to talk about issues like this so straightforwardly because it's very sort of, you know, it's taboo. You're not really supposed to talk about stuff like that.
Hmm.
Like for example, they had a period of inactivity of 7 years, and their first song after 7 years of inactivity is called Pachinko Yatteru Aida ni Umarete Mamo Nai Musume o Kurumo no Naka de Shinaseta Natsu, which in English means the summer I left my baby daughter to die in the car while I was playing pachinko.
Sounds light and pleasant.
Yes, but see, the thing is, the composition for the song, I'll get into their style. They are, like I said, it's this really sort of, you know, upbeat, you know, sort of 70s, you know, funky beat. And if you didn't know what the lyrics are about, you're like, oh, this is just a nice song. But the chorus is the guy is sort of going on. Well, it's actually the main character is like a housewife. And actually the lyrics are kind of like, you know, oh, my husband who doesn't work and this child who I'm not used to taking care of. Pachinko helps me forget about them. And I left the window a little bit open in the car, but when I got there, you know, it doesn't end pleasantly. So yeah, it was a big shock after 7 years for that sort of thing to come out. And the cover for the single is the inside of a car. And what you should notice about it is that it has lots of cute stuff on it. And do you know Yankee?
No.
Okay, Yankees are like Japanese punks, and they drop out of junior high school and high school, and I should know because I live kind of in the country where I see Yankee all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And since these people are idiots, they work sort of blue-collar jobs and have nothing better to do with their lives, and they're really into dumb, cute things. And so the kind of interesting thing about this cover is that while it has like this really dark, you know, title and this really sort of a lot of their covers are drawn by not famous manga artists, but sort of underground manga artists.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this really grim sort of realistic style. You don't actually see the child, mind you. It's just the inside of the car. It's tasteful. But there's just all these, like, there's a teddy bear. There's, like, all these, like, cute things on the seats. So it's really interesting contrast. And, but yeah, they had two professional albums back in the 90s, which have, like, these, like, really, like, Japanese names. The first one is called Daidi Haha, which means surrogate mother. And the second one's called ongaku girai, which means music hatred, and like they have the interesting thing about the older stuff is like while the style of music is really American, like the imagery and a lot of the stuff and all their titles are completely in Japanese. There's like no like English in them, so and the subject matter is very Japanese. And so it makes for a very interesting contrast. And one of their big influences is like old Japanese music. Like the band leader. I went to a you know Tomohiro Machiyama, right?
It doesn't sound familiar.
Oh, the guy Tomohiro Machiyama, like the movie critic in Japan?
Never heard of him.
Really? Yeah. Okay. Patrick Macias talks about him a lot. Anyway, he had a talk with he loves the band, so he had a talk with the main guys, the vocalist, and the band leader, and some of their big influences were like Japan in like the Showa era, like basically sort of World War II, kind of all the way up to like the late 80s, and old Showa era music, and lots of old Japanese music used to be about the kind of stuff they talk about in their songs now, and basically they kind of long for that era where songs could be more honest and just sort of about stuff that is kind of unpleasant, but hey, the world's unpleasant, and you know, and they're not about, you know, actually the name of the talk was like, we're sick and tired of songs about believing in things like tomorrow and Sakura. So they're basically just trying to, a lot of their music is a big fuck you to Japanese pop music.
Yeah.
And I, yeah, yeah. So I kind of just want to go through some of their titles, like some...
Well, let me ask first.
Yes, please, because it's just me talking, so yes,
is
go ahead.
So this is considered an anomaly, because, I mean, there's tons of American music that's a fuck you to pop music.
Yes,
is there just not
yes.
that much of that in Japan? Is this sort of like an outside, like really
yes,
rare thing?
Exactly. Like, there is definitely lots of indie stuff that's kind of weird and that it's kind of a fuck you, but... It doesn't make it to the mainstream, and Omokage Lucky Hole isn't mainstream, but I guess the interesting thing about them isn't just the fact that they're fucking you to pop music, it's sort of the very, sort of, like, it's the biting commentary on, you know, their society, and sort of their weird mix of influences, like, sort of the old Japanese influence, and, like, the old American influence, and, you know, and sort of, like, also... the fact that they're all perverts, that works into it, too. It's just kind of like this very interesting mix of weird things that I kind of dig.
It also brings to mind that it must be... I wonder if it just based on, you know, Japanese culture, it must be easy... this is not the right word, but it feels like maybe it's easier to be subversive as a musician there. Because there are fewer people breaking taboos... in such a public way. Because here, like, find me a musician that's actually edgy. Like, seriously.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you gotta go into real weird dark places to find anything that's even remotely subversive that hasn't been done a million times in American music.
Yeah.
But
I think
go ahead.
Sorry, I think what you're saying is very correct.
Okay.
And the reason I like them isn't really because they're edgy, I just like what they're saying.
Right.
Like, I don't like. I like it definitely because you know it's kind of weird and awkward, but it's not like oh they're so on the edge and crazy. Like they're goofy. I've been to their shows. They're goofy.
Mm-hmm.
Like the shows always end with like the main vocalist stripping down all his clothes and he's like in his underwear and he's just like dancing around on stage. They're really dumb.
Uh-huh.
And he's a fat old man, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah, but anyway, I just kind of want to go through some of their song titles so you can kind of get an idea. What they're about. So the very first song on their very first indies release, because they were actually on an indies label at first, and they put out one album, which I bought for a ton of money, because it's very rare. And the first, very first song, it's kind of one of their, it's like their meaning of purpose. It's called Konya Sugamode, or Tonight in Sugamo, which is a neighborhood in Tokyo on the upper end of the Yamanote line. And it's filled with old people. I've been there once. It's just filled with old people. Right when you get out the station, they're blasting Inca music. That's how old people it is. Inca is like the really old Japanese like music. It's really dramatic, which is part of their influences. But anyway, that song is about just to sort of like make their what they're all about like really clear. It's about like a young woman and she's in Sugamo, taken there by her grandmother, and she meets an old man, and they sort of hit it off, and it's sort of about their weird kind of gross romance. And the interesting thing about that song, it definitely has lots of weird innuendo in it, but it also has lots of really old Japanese references. When I sung in front of a Japanese person, they're like, "Do you know what you're talking about?" I sung this at karaoke. It's like, "Do you know?" Because some of their songs are at karaoke. You have to kind of request them, though. But they're like, "Do you know what? Do you know the words in this song?" Because there's lots of really old references in it to, like, you know, like the Taisho era, which is like the era before Showa. And it's just it's really cultural stuff. And actually, I'll say it anyway. One of the lyric they leave you on before it goes into an instrumental break is that there's a white-haired head buried down there. Down there being the woman's down there, of course. So that's, you know, that's, okay. That's what they're all about. And, they have song about hostesses, songs about, like I said, couples that aren't really doing so well. There's this one great song called Watashi ga kurama isu ni nattemo, which is means even if I end up in a wheelchair. And it's about this song's very comical. It's basically about a woman who gets hit by a truck.
Okay.
And she has to go to the hospital, and like and her husband's just a jerk. He's like, "Doctor, I just have one question." She's paralyzed from the waist down. "Doctor, I have one question. How will this affect our sex life?" And then the next verse, he just asks the lawyer for a divorce. So it's like, it's really cruel, it's really mean, and it's just kind of retarded. But and it's really upbeat, too, so, you know. And wow. They have another song called Kore ga Korona Monde, which I didn't know what that means, except for it's a Japanese slang that means basically she's been knocked up. And it's about, like, this, like, a Yankee who, like, he lives a life playing pachinko, smoking, drinking, and going to the boat races, but he's thrown that all away because he needs to protect the ones he loves. But it all goes south in the end anyway because, you know, his wife was working at a dirty shop behind his back to, you know, make ends meet, and he gets kind of pissed off. And the whole song kind of goes downhill. And
Well, hey, listen, this has been really fascinating. We're actually we're into my next call. I gotta get to my next call. So
I'm sorry,
but no, that was really actually really really fascinating. What was the name of that band again?
Oh, sorry, Omokage Lucky Hole. If you search them in English on Google, my blog will be the first thing that pops up.
Okay, well, people know where to find it. That was really interesting. Look at that stuff, man. I appreciate you coming on and letting us know. Okay, we're back. We're talking now with Tony. Tony, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks to be here.
What's on your mind, man?
Well, I was just thinking, it's been brought up previously in some of your other shows or some of your other guests about, you know, as people start to collect larger collections of media, you know, anime, manga in particular here, organizing on how, you know, start running out of space, and then also how do you keep track of your actual individual libraries of stuff? Because I've noticed people I follow on Twitter, you know, different anime fellow, you know, followers and whatnot, they, I see a lot of people actually double dipping on stuff because they've already previously purchased a title, but then they, just because they haven't organized it well, they end up rebuying a title without even really realizing it.
Yeah. It happens.
Yeah. So, I mean, with me personally, I had to break down a couple of years ago and start organizing my stuff because, unfortunately, owning a 550-foot square foot home in a depressed housing market doesn't really give me a chance to expand that much.
Right.
So as my collection's grown over the years, and I've been collecting since, you know, the late 90s, you know, got into anime right about the time the DVD started coming out. So mm-hmm. I've been collecting, you know, and then I got into manga in about the mid-2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been getting about as big as my DVD collection. I pretty much gave up on, you know, shelving my manga collection. So I've been having to basically box those up and store them. And I've been using a piece of software on the Mac called Delicious Library that allows you to scan in, you know, via UPC codes and it basically pulls the metadata from Amazon for the different titles and stuff and allows you to organize and that sort of thing. So I've been personally, labeling storage containers, and then as I, buy more manga, scan it in and then box it up so I can basically keep track of individual titles, individual volumes, that sort of thing. I've been starting to do it on the DVD side, but I'm still shelving that, but I'm running out of space there. I'm probably going to have to break down and start boxing up some of my anime titles also, because I basically at this point I've got an 8-foot by 4-foot shelving. That thing's been stacked for a couple of years now, and I've been stacking up on top of it up to the ceiling and stuff. So I'm probably going to have to break down and start taking some of the older titles and start boxing those up too.
Right. Yeah. I know that Justin's solution to this was to buy these gigantic airline DJ cases that he just, and I think he keeps the inserts, tosses the cases, and then organizes just the discs.
Yeah, I've heard that previously on the podcast, and I've thought about that, but I like boxes. I like the different, I get a lot of the limited edition stuff, so I've got a lot of the older one-off stuff, like the old, like that big old dot hack octagonal thing.
Yeah.
I got the Serial Experiment Lane lunchbox DVD box set and stuff. So I like a lot of the individual boxes. They look nice on the shelf. But yeah, that's one nice thing about going to the box sets nowadays, as opposed to the one-off volumes back in the day. It does save you shelf space.
Right. Yeah. I'm kind of the same way. I don't think I could ever just put all my discs in a box or something. I want to see my library. Like, I've invested all this money and time and effort into collecting and organizing, and I want to see it. Like, I want to have it on display. And that's a rare, that is an increasingly rare thing in today's media consumption landscape.
That's why I want to bring up, too, with the move to digital on the downloadable side. I mean, if you're, sidestep the whole fan sub BitTorrent stuff, just for, either streaming or downloading individual episodes from, say, iTunes, or now with J-Manga popping up on the manga side. I haven't jumped to J-Manga yet. I like physical books, so it's like I'm still old school like that. But now with them starting to release some of the incomplete Delray titles from Kodansha, mm-hmm. I'm probably going to have to break down and start getting titles on the J-Manga side. But when it comes to, your libraries on that, basically media storage and media organizing completely changes, because you physical space is all about hard drive space. But organizing, making sure where you have stuff and if it's backed up and that sort of thing.
It's interesting. I recently I had a real epiphany about this whole thing when it comes to digital versus physical media, because I recently built a rig for PC gaming, which is a completely different beast from console gaming, and I found I've switched over completely to digital games. Like, I do not buy boxed games anymore, at least not for the time being. And I've found that there's upsides and downsides to it, and I think this sort of applies across the board when it comes to manga. Manga's sort of inherently consumable, and then, I don't know how often you reread your collection, but there's just so much of it that I feel like digital is the way to go on manga, just because it's not taking up that much space. You read it, you move on to the next thing, and you don't have to have a shelf full of books. But video games, I'm finding, are it's coming around the same way. The only huge downside to it is that video games are still expensive. And if you buy something you don't like, you don't have the option of selling it or trading it in anywhere. You are stuck with it. And to me, that's the biggest downside to digital. Digital anything. Is that if I have a collection, I can't prune it and get some of that value back. I'm stuck with it. And that's already happened to me a few times on, I bought like $50 PC game, didn't really like it. Well, I'm just stuck with it. There's nothing I can do. I can't take it to GameStop. I can't sell it on eBay. I can't do anything with it. And to me, that kind of sucks. And I definitely don't want to go all digital with movies. I just don't. I like having the physical product.
I'm actually right with you on that, because I have done purges in the past on my manga and my anime library, just incomplete titles I just never finished, or stuff I have completed that I just know I'm never going to revisit. I've just, but I have been able to do that. I've, just thrown a bunch of stuff up on eBay or gone to a local bookseller and, you know, used bookseller and, you know, sold titles that way just to free up space. And like you said, with the digital stuff, there's no real option for that. And as I said, for like the manga side, I do like the physical book. I can see the draw of reading, you know, especially for the, I say the non-collector type of manga, the shonen shoujo stuff that's, you know, very consumable. I could see the appeal of, you know, going digital that way. Yeah. But there's still titles that you still want, that are nice, that you actually want to collect and actually have physical copies of.
Yeah, sure. And that's the same for me, too. Like, my anime collection is just titles that I think I'm going to watch again. That's it. I don't keep anything else. And that's because so much anime comes in and out of my house. But I only keep the stuff that I feel like I'm going to revisit at some point. So it's classics, it's Evangelion, Utena, Escaflowne, you know, my personal favorites that I'm going to watch again. If I don't think I'm going to watch something again, I don't keep it.
Yeah, actually, I've done that a bit myself, but I've run into one issue with that. With older titles that have gone, I mean, I getting into DVDs fairly early, I bought a lot of the individual volume stuff. And, you know, back when anime was first coming out, there wasn't a lot out there. So it was actually, I bought a lot of the early stuff just because it was the only stuff getting released over here. Mm-hmm. And looking back on it, a lot of it is pretty much garbage.
Yep.
But a lot of it is also out of print now. Yeah. So I have run into the, you know, the atrophying of, you know, I'm probably never going to revisit this title, but it's no longer in print. You can't even get it anymore. So it's sort of the collector mentality of, you know, do I get rid of this because I'm not personally going to use it at all or watch it anymore? Or do I just, but the fact that it's out of print now and, you know, value collecting or whatever.
Right. Yeah. That's the other thing I have found, even if I don't want something that I have, if I've had something in my collection for a really long time and I go, I'm like, I should get rid of this. And I go and I look and it's like, oh, you know, people are asking $200 for it on Amazon. I don't get rid of it, which is silly. I should sell it, get the $150 or whatever I can for it and buy things I actually am going to watch with that money. But there is a weird collector mentality where it's like, well, this is valuable, so I should hang on to this thing I don't want. It's really silly.
I think if you did a Venn diagram of, you know, collectors and OCD, there's probably quite a bit of overlap there.
Yeah, I'm sure. but, you know, just in general, the idea of having a big physical media library is basically out the window at this point. And I have to admit, like, I switched over to digital on books completely, and that's mostly a space issue. I have X number of bookshelves, they're full. So the fact that if I want to read this next huge book, I'll just buy it on and read it on my iPad. That's, to me, I'm fine with that. I don't miss physical books like at all.
In terms of text type books. Yeah. I can really see the appeal there with that. Because as I said, I've got a tablet, I've got, you know, one of the little Nexus 7s and stuff. And, I can see the appeal there. It's just with, especially with the manga, especially with titles I really like, you know, say Drops of God and stuff like that. The physical book is nice to have, and it's a little bit more, you don't have to worry about running out of battery or running out of, you know, internet connection. Because that's the other thing with digital too, is that if you lose a title or you lose a download or something, are you going to necessarily be able to re-download it in the future if, you know, they've lost the title, you know, wherever you got it from, has lost the license or whatnot?
Well, I've had some, at this point, you know, in all the different ways that I've purchased digital media, either digital books or games or movies or whatever, have not run into any issues with that at all. However, we're getting to the point where this technology is old enough now to where we are going to start seeing some services die off. And it'll be interesting to see what happens when a service that sold a lot but, you know, went out of business or whatever eventually goes kaput, and then what happens to all that digital content? Are you just shit out of luck? I mean, obviously, legally, you are shit out of luck. You're buying a license to basically let someone let you see something. You're not purchasing a book or anything like that. So, yeah, I can imagine that would be huge, and that's one of the reasons that I think I'm still so dedicated to the notion of buying movies and collecting them and keeping them on a shelf, because I don't want to someday be told, sorry, our license to the Royal Tenenbaums expired, so you're going to have to go find it somewhere else. No, I want to be able to take that movie off my shelf and watch it whenever I want to. I don't want there to be a gatekeeper between me and that particular piece of media. So,
yeah, that happened with me with the Bandai announcement with them shutting doors. First thing I did was hop on Right Stuff and just start picking the few handful of titles that I hadn't owned yet that I just hadn't gotten around to, like Planetez and, you know, it's a couple of Gundam titles that, you know, didn't really have overly eager to watch them, but I knew once they're gone, they're gone. There's just they're, especially with the smaller run titles that just were never popular, they're never going to get re-released.
Yeah,
I did the same thing with the Genion releases. I'm still working through that backlog from like 5 years ago.
There's a lot of, a lot of the Bandai stuff, I would imagine you're going to see Funimation re-releasing it like in a couple of years' time, more than likely. Some of those licenses, letting them lapse or having them not in print is literally just leaving money on the table. So I don't know that a lot of that stuff is going to stay out of print. But the little titles, like, you know, the stuff that Bandai licensed that, just no way in hell is it going to get a re-release. Yeah, I mean, you better snap it up if you want access to it, because the odds that anyone's going to be selling it digitally either are really low.
The Cowboy Bebops and the Escaflowne's and stuff, yeah, those will get picked up easy. But, of course, I bought those, you know, a decade ago. As I said, some of the smaller titles, as I said, like Planetez, I'm questionable if that ever gets picked up again. It might get, like, you know, maybe through Discotech or something.
But it's a big gamble. But the physical media exists. You can still buy it, so you may as well, you know?
But as I said, it's one of those things where I have a feeling the titles are going to start running out quick. And as I figured, as soon as they announced that they were going to stop releasing stuff, I just, you know, as I ordered the few things I wanted, because, like you said, it's like once they're gone, and not necessarily a chance of they're going to be out there. Maybe not, but do you really want to gamble on that?
Yeah, you know, I feel like a lot of people are really conflicted because, you know, the issue here isn't that I don't want to buy things or whatever, I don't want to collect. But a lot of the commentary that you see pop up whenever a company decides that, you know, like Bandai, that was just a decision. Bandai was actually doing fairly okay. They were keeping their head above water. It was a decision on the part of the Japanese company to basically pull the plug. When something like that happens, you see all these people going, oh man, I'm going to wait for this to go on sale. I'm going to wait for it to drop a little bit more. Well, it'll be in stock for another couple of months. And to me, that's more like you're deciding whether or not you still want to be a physical media collector, not whether or not you actually want the product. And I feel like a lot of that discussion boils down to that. This is more about somebody's personal decision to not collect physical media anymore, which is where a lot of people are going. And I think a lot of anime fans are going that way too. I would say probably the majority of anime fans now do not have giant anime libraries.
No, this is strictly a problem of the older fans. Because I think it's just general younger audience in general are more used to the digital media. Yeah. I mean, they've grown up in the age of iTunes and Hulu and, you know, that sort of thing. So the whole idea that you actually, you know, buy physical copies of your content seems kind of old and out of date from that point, you know, just from that point.
Yeah. The other big thing for me in physical media is lending. Being able to say, oh, you haven't seen this movie, you got to see it, and then you loan it to them. You can't do that with the digital media at all. And to me, that's a big deal. I like being able to do that.
Or just taking titles over to other people's places. If you want to show a movie or, you know, a show or something, it's like, oh, let me make sure I grab my laptop or, you know, this hard drive or whatever, because that's the only copy I have. Because you don't have a connection at your place, or it's going to take an hour to download, you know, whatever title off of iTunes. It's easier just to throw a disc in a bag and go that way.
Yeah. I dread the day when someone says, hey, it's movie night, and we have to huddle around a laptop. Like, I just, that just sounds like the worst thing.
Yeah. No, I've done that in the past, and yeah, that's not the best viewing experience. I mean, my first DVD player was a DVD drive into my PC back in like 98. And yeah, my first few DVD movies, I remember watching the Sixth Sense. Yeah, it was basically the family huddled around my CRT monitor. And it was like, we enjoyed the movie, but yeah, it's like, we're getting kind of sick of sitting on this, you know, corner of the bed or the, you know, desk chair and that sort of thing.
I think my first DVD player I bought from a Circuit City, so that was, that doesn't exist anymore. I think it was like, everybody made a big deal about it at the anime club because it was the first time we'd seen one that was like, somewhat affordable. So this one was like, I remember thinking it was like $80 or something like that. And that was considered screaming deal for a DVD player. And this was like 99. And I think my first DVD was Batman Beyond, that Return of the Joker movie.
Yeah.
Man, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, actually, I remember my first title was that. Actually, you know, once again on the anime side, it was actually the Sailor Moon movies getting released on DVD, because it was like they had had a VHS release, but I hadn't had a chance to watch it subtitled at all. And, you know, I'd only, you know, back then only been exposed to the English dub.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of where you, like, you get the, you know, Japanese track on it with subtitles that you can turn on and off was just, you know, mind blowing. So it's like, okay, I got a DVD drive. Okay, what do I get for now? And I think like the first one had just been released by Pioneer at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's, you know, it's like, I like the show. I like the series. I'm just getting into anime at the time. So, hey, yeah, easy pick there.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure my first anime DVD was Cowboy Bebop, the first single on that. And then shortly after, I probably bought Trigun. And yeah, it was all in that era. Those days are basically done at this point. It's not that physical media is dead by a long shot. It's still lifeblood of a lot of the industry. But the days where your average anime fan is like, "Hey, check out my closet full of carefully organized DVDs," no, just us old timers from the late 90s. Yeah,
yeah, raging out on that.
But yeah, I think I will always probably always have... I mean, this is... Obviously, it's a foolish thing to say, but I can't really imagine not having a big library of movies in my den or, you know, or my living room. That just seems like a fixture that will always be there, even though that's probably inaccurate and not going to actually go that way, given the way things are actually going. But I hope it stays that way. I hope I can still buy movies, you know, 10 years from now.
Yeah, same here. As I said, I'm old school like that, where I still like my books and I still like my discs.
Yeah, I was really still surprised at how quick I was like, oh, this is obviously the future on books. Like, I don't know what happened there. Like, the minute I loaded up iBooks and popped open, you know, whatever, I was like, oh, this is obviously the way to do this. But comics are even better. Especially if you have the new iPad, the resolution on that thing makes comics look amazing. It is many times the resolution of print. So,
yeah, no, I have a feeling, as especially with J-Manga, because there's a lot of those Del Rey titles that they never finished a physical publication of. And, you know, now if J-Manga picking those titles up and they're going to continue on the ones that are incomplete, there's enough of those where it's like, yeah, I'm going to have to dip into that. And I have a feeling it's sort of the same thing. Once I actually start getting into it, I have a feeling I'll probably go whole hog on that too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a thing where once you take the plunge, you realize why so many people are doing it that way. But anyway, it was great having you on to chat a little bit about collecting, man. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to everybody who showed up. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a little rating, a little review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.